Kwandu on 702. 15 minutes after 10 o'clock, we celebrate with our Indian, South African Indian community here today on Kwantu. 162 years since the arrival of the first cohort of indentured slaves or enslaved Indians. It's important how we use these words, hey Chris? Because, you know, to say that people are slaves versus that people were enslaved are two very, very different things. We've had the conversation about the transatlantic slavery situation, and somebody pointed that out to me, that these were not African slaves. They were Africans who were enslaved. Yeah? And of course, the same is true with those people that were enslaved by that indenture system coming from India, who have now become such an integral part of South Africa's fabric. And joining me to have this conversation is Selvan Naidu. Selvan, thank you so much for joining me, my brother. I appreciate your time.
Good evening, Aubrey. Wonderful to join you.
Much appreciated.
Phenomenal topic.
Indeed. And Kiru Naidu, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Much appreciated. Are you brothers?
Well, we related somewhere along the line, I'm sure. Delighted to join you, Aubrey.
Great stuff. Kiru, great to have you on the show. And may I say, happy anniversary, 162 years of our Indian community here in South Africa. What does it mean to you, Kiru?
Well, those are kind sentiments, Aubrey, but we take the view that it's not a celebration. This is a commemoration. We mark a particular point in the history of our country. And, you know, like you point out with the transatlantic slave trade, and you and I have had this discussion before,
yeah.
This is an ugly history here. And as we reflect on this in the same way that we talk about African migrant labor, for instance, and all of the trepidations that went with that.
Sure. And I suppose My celebration is really more of the contribution that the Indian community has made to the South African reality, a positive contribution. So I suppose my celebration is more on that side of the story. But I get your point that the circumstances that led for the population that is of Indian folks in South Africa, the circumstances that led them coming here is nothing to celebrate at all. And what is the attitude just in terms of remembering that moment at the moment? You said it was more of a commemoration, but is there a deep sense of sadness about that at the moment?
Well, there's both sadness and positive sentiment. And we look at this contribution of the community of Indian origin in South Africa, along with the contributions of everybody else in building sure. our country, in uniting our people, in creating the prosperity that South Africa is, but unfortunately that prosperity does not exist to everybody, does not extend to everybody.
Yeah.
So those are some of the challenges we face in our society and for which we are working to correct.
And then, of course, Selvan, tell me of the education around this issue, around the arrival of Indian folks in South Africa. How much of it is taught to South African children of Indian descent, but more broadly to South African children generally? How much of that history is taught, and how much of it should we be learning?
I think, you know, from 2010. On the commemoration of the 150th
yes.
anniversary of indentured worker arrival to the country, there's been a momentum, there's been impetus, and largely because of people being able to. Now, for a large part of history, when people are in struggle and essentially economically disempowered, history doesn't become an issue in terms of commemoration. But since 2010, there's been quite impetus in terms of the community itself. But still, in terms of the curriculum, it becomes problematized in many ways. I turn to my own children and ask them how much of this history is being taught in their syllabus. And to my high school going child, who's now in matric. In grade 8, she was barely taught elements of indentured history, particularly to Natal. And then in grade 10, it's maybe taught where you have probably two pages. So to the Indian community living out in Indian African community living out in South Africa, it's not as intense as it's hoped to be. And to the broader South African public, it problematized in a much vast way. And the impact is clearly visible by people not understanding the issues that you brought into focus, enslavement versus slavery versus indenture. So I think in the collective narrative of South Africa, the story of indenture is not something that's widely taught and widely known for that matter.
Tell us in broad strokes the history, Kiru. What happened? What was the set of circumstances, if you will, that led to the enslavement of Indian folks in India? And I know it wasn't, you know, the classical enslavement as perhaps we've come to understand things like the transatlantic enslavement. I'm told that it was more insidious. People were promised a better life, and you could tell us about that story. What happened? How did the Indian community end up on the southern tip of Africa?
Well, it's very much the historical moment. In 1834, slavery was outlawed in the British Empire. But with all of the colonies that the imperialists and colonialists had, everywhere from colonial Natal to Jamaica to Fiji to Mauritius, Guadeloupe, Guyana, all around the globe, there was still this hunger for labor. And so they created the system of bonded labor. So this was enslavement by a written contract, if you like. And people were transported, in this instance, to colonial Natal to work the sugar plantation. But that bondage also extended to the railways, domestic service, the tea plantation. The coal mines were also a very significant part. And in our research for this book, The Indian Africans, we found that indenture reproduced the actual conditions of slavery, the harshness and violence on the plantation, the idea that you had no freedom of movement. You know, Indians carried passes right well into the 20th century, and you could be imprisoned for not carrying a pass.
Yeah.
So all these restrictions and the violence on the plantations, what was a really vicious form of labor control and oppression on these plantations and elsewhere that people were bonded.
My former colleague Joanne Joseph has written a powerful book that documents, albeit in a form of a novel, so it's not necessarily a documentary, but it documents the reality in the book that she wrote, Children of Sugarcane, a book that I'd recommend to every South African to read. Really powerful stuff. I'm actually a little bit pained that Joanne never agreed to come and talk to me or my show about her book. But a really powerful account of that moment, and really something that I would encourage our listeners to get a hold of. Selvin, what was the tale? What were people in India being told at the time that made it such an attractive prospect to go to far-flung parts of the world like colonial Natal at that time?
Well, from the research and from much of our reading and through this wonderful book called An Era of Darkness by Shashi Tharoor, we've come to understand that the Indians at that particular time who lived, many of whom lived in a rural part of India, close on 80%. And at that particular time, by the 1800s, the British had systematically destroyed the rural economies of rural India, which meant that people were forced to leave and look for new opportunities. And we must remember in the 1800s, there was lots of opportunities for people to travel by ship to all parts of the world. There's two theories that exist in terms of scholarly research. one that speaks of agency and one that speaks of enslavement.
Yeah.
By 1974, the theory was that indenture was a new system of slavery. And in recent years, we speak of agency in terms of the indentured Indians using, or Indians in India, using the system of, system of indenture to move to different parts of the world and so on. But particularly when we turn to Natal and Fiji, there's evidence that suggests that the enslavement and the subsequent enslavement is the evidence that, and the brutal system, as Kiru had pointed out, we refer to this in a chapter called The Violence of Indenture. That is substantive proof that this was a system of enslavement. While they may have left voluntarily to escape the harshness of rural life in India at that particular time, when they arrived in places like Natal and specifically Fiji, it became enslavement. But they left India because the British had systematically destroyed the economies. In some instances, where families were involved in particular trades and so on, in the textile industry and so on, where we read Sajid Tharoor's books, it speaks about how craftsmen had their thumbs cut off simply because of wanting to destroy that particular rural economy in order for Britain to be able to import its cotton into India.
Yeah.
So this is the idea, that people left supposedly for a better life. And there's also evidence about people being lied to, people being duped. For example, there were many instances through records that suggest that people were thinking that they were leaving to the urban environment and leaving the rural areas, and then ended up going to the port cities and the very next minute, because they were illiterate in English and didn't understand, they were then forced into ships and found themselves in the various colonies where labor was taken to.
Yeah, that lie seems to be a very, very present reality in almost all of the stories of enslavement of various peoples around the world. That lie of going to people in the hinterland of various countries in the rural areas and telling them giving them promises of a better life, only to be kidnapped at the shores and then be whisked away to different parts of the world. I'm very familiar with those lies, Selvan. The issue, just technically, Kiru, and I remember the last time you and I had that conversation, somebody came on and so forth. But just technically explain to me what we're talking about when we speak about indentured labor. Some have called it indentured slavery. What is that, technically speaking?
Well, technically speaking, it's a contract. You sign over your freedom for 5 or 10 years in this instance. That's the way it was originally. But we also found in the records that because the situation was so oppressive with the taxation, there was a tax called the £3 tax. So once you were freed from indenture and you opted to remain in South Africa and not return to India, you were faced with the harsh tax that was a very large proportion of your annual earnings. And many people re-indentured. Some records show that there were people indentured to the plantations right until the late 1930s. So it was a way of pinning you down and holding you on the plantations and not wanting you to go out and be a free agent of your labor. You know, and these stories, I'm glad you make the reference to Joanne Joseph, and we must tip our hats to her. Her book, Children of Sugarcane, was named the best book of 2022.
Oh, powerful stuff. Powerful stuff,
amazing.
Kira.
She's captured that so wonderfully. And in her book and in our writing of the Indian Africans, you know, we've talked through this line of race, of ethnicity, of identity. And I'm so pleased that you refer also to Dumsane Hlophe and his reference to spiritual identity, because we talk through this theme as well. Look at this, Dumsane and I are having a debate through other mouths on the radio, and he and I have not talked in ages.
It's well, what do they call it? I think they call it serendipity, eh, Kiru? So ultimately, people get onto these boats. They are taken to this part of the world. You speak of you know, the explanation you've given now about the signing of over of your freedom. Strangely, I've been hearing a lot of that coming out of Qatar, even now with the World Cup, and people suggesting that similar things have been done in the process of building the stadia. People have had to sign away their freedom. In fact, even some of them had to hand over their passports. So, you know, these practices seem not to have completely disappeared. So, Selvan, people arrive in Africa. People in the boats, and I'm told that the conditions in the boats were frankly quite horrendous. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. But then they arrive here in South Africa, what was then the British colony of Natalia. What happens?
So effectively for South Africa or Natal, in terms of the migration, there were 384 ships, and these ships arrived between the years 1860 to 1911, in which there were 152,000 people that arrived between those years. In the earlier years, because indenture had replaced slavery, the conditions on board the ships of indenture were far better than they were during the years of slavery, because it meant that the system of indenture was legislated in order to prevent what had happened in slavery. However, having said that, we know specifically, and a point to be made here, is that the colonial planters, specifically for Natal, and in growing an ailing economy, wanted the cheapest labor possible. So they turned to this experiment that Kiru mentioned earlier in Mauritius, that was called the Great Experiment, where sugar cane was grown successfully in Mauritius. And they turned to India in the provision of this cheap form of labor. It wasn't as if African labor was not available in Natal. It was available, but the planters themselves, and by the mission of the planters themselves, specifically Edward Morwood, who speaks in 1855 that there was African labor available, but simply the planters had agitated for the system of indenture to be introduced into South Africa, that indentured labor was brought to South Africa, and the commodity of cheap labor was used simply to grow this ailing colonial economy. But in terms of the earlier years, and going back to your question with regard to the ship's conditions, we note the two ships that arrived on the 16th of November 1860, and the second ship, which is called the Belvedere, arrives on the 26th, 10 days later, 1860. So on the 26th of November, we launch our book in Pietermaritzburg, where we will pay tribute and we will commemorate the 29 lives that were lost in transit from Calcutta to Natal. The 29 people had passed because of the atrocious ship's conditions. The water on board was absolutely poor, and therefore people ended up with ailments in terms of dysentery and a whole host of others, and 29 people passed. And what's worse was that when they arrived, they were quarantined at the bluff in tents, and a further 10 people died. So in total, 39 people passed before they could even get to the plantation. So that's an indication of how horrible the ship's conditions were. And in our book, Indian Africans, we have these wonderful pictures. It's wonderful, but when you look at it, it's wonderful in terms of research, but when you look at it, it starts to enable the viewer to fix the gaze in terms of the harshness and the brutality of indenture, because these were people that were huddled on ships. And there's a comparative study that we do in a chapter called The Class Apart, where we discuss how Europeans have arrived in Natal versus how indentured have arrived, and the conditions are vastly different. So that speaks to the ship's conditions in terms of how the indentured arrived.
Who owned these ships? And, of course, I imagine the plantations, Kiro. Was it companies? Was it the government of British colonial Natal? Who were the owners of this effort to bring people from India to Africa? What was the arrangement there?
Well, this was a massive trade in people, and we must locate this debate within human trafficking, because that was human trafficking of the 18th and 19th centuries. So these were, you know, massive ship owners all over England and Scotland in particular. So some of the big names of British families, all of whom benefited from, or whose wealth was founded on the transatlantic slave trade, continued to benefit when their ships were used in the indenture trade. And these were called coolie ships. And that's a derogatory word in the South African lexicon.
Yeah.
But we use it freely in our work to demonstrate a particular moment in history. And by using it like other derogatory racial terms, we hope that we might be liberating it to show that this the ugliness around it. But this was a case of, you know, tendering for human cargo. So you had particular consignments of human cargo leaving the ports of Calcutta and of Madras in the south. And the ship's captains were paid on the basis of how many live souls they landed. So as Selvan points out there, every person that died on board and had their bodies thrown over or through some means lost their lives, that was a loss for the ship owners and the ship captains and crew. So this was a hectic trade. And earlier you made reference to the enslavement of people in Qatar. And we still have this kind of modern-day slavery all over the world. In fact, the United Nations says that slavery is actually on the increase.
Yeah.
We have slave markets in Libya, in Mauritania, in so many different parts of our continent and in Asia and elsewhere. So we should see this continuity of history and fight for the liberation of people all over the world.
Talk to me about what was going on in India itself during that time, Selvan. I mean, we often hear about the caste system in India, and some have suggested that over and above the effects of British colonialism in India, there was also this system, this caste system that made people look for, shall we say, greener pastures elsewhere, and that's why people would then even consider the handing over of their freedom through that whole indentured process. Talk to me about that. To what extent is there truth in that, and to what extent did that contribute perhaps to people making the decision that they were going to go?
There's a fair element of truth in that, that's for certain. You know, when we look through records, official records, and we look through oral testimony, many of the indentured left to escape that brutal system. And while that system of caste may have had good intentions when it started off in terms of religious scripture, I think man by their very nature, or humankind by their very nature, manipulates systems to suit certain individuals.
Yeah.
So essentially that happens throughout history, and that's happened in India. In terms of the indentured using that as one of the reasons to escape, that was clearly in place because to advance oneself in society, certain elements need to be in place. And if you typecast in a particular caste in this particular instance, you know, your advancement in life is restricted to certain areas or certain professions and such. So clearly that was the case of people wanting to escape. And the narrative was that once people from India had left, they crossed the dark ocean waters, which was called the Kalapani, that they left their caste at the port cities of India and they came to South Africa. And the wonderful news that we have in terms of South Africa is that the caste system is not entrenched in South Africa. We have a long history of brotherhood, of being able to work together. And the strange thing that we see is that through these 384 ships list, there would have been names, surnames that you have listed that would be uncommon to the Naidus and the Chettis and so on, largely because they were incorrectly captured when people had arrived.
Mm.
But equally, there were some people that did change their caste. And we have many Singhs and we have many Maharajas and so on, who that was not necessarily the case in terms of the ship's registers and so on. But over time, they were able to change their surnames and so on. But clearly, in South Africa, I think we're very proud in terms of a long history of the caste system not being a factor, and where people from different faiths, and we know with the Truro, they were that the first ship that arrived, that they were more Christians than they were Hindu. When we look throughout the whole history and we mine the data, they were 80% of those people that arrived between those years of 1860 to 1911 were Hindu in the majority. But that being said, we had Christians, we had Muslims, and people that were able to come together, and especially in the oppressive and the brutal system of indenture, being able to forge common bonds and being able to work together. And Kay will speak a little bit more about how those common bonds became the system of resistance in terms of how indenture was resisted and protested by the years of the 1913 strikes and later on by the 1946, which gives vent to the non-racial struggle for freedom in our country.
Yeah. I'd like to invite South Africans of Indian descent to be part of this conversation and perhaps give some depth and insight to this conversation. Your heritage as as South Africans of Indian descent, and your connection perhaps to the subcontinent of India, perhaps culturally, perhaps religiously. How do you navigate that? How does your South Africanness versus your Indian heritage play itself out here in South Africa? I'd be interested to take some of those calls on 011-883-0702. Kiru, I get the sense that there was very little contact with the subcontinent by Indians who had come to South Africa and made South Africa their home. Let me ask it this way: how much contact culturally remained with the subcontinent after the indentured laborers were sort of assimilated into South African society, as it were, if that is in fact something true? I mean, the fragmented nature of South African society at that time, the separation, the insulation from each other, sometimes makes me wonder whether there was any real integration in those early years. But to what extent was there contact still between the subcontinent in various ways with those that had become assimilated into the South African reality? Kiru?
Virtually no contact at all, especially for the people of Indian indentured origins. And we're looking at a process of migration that is as recent as 120 years ago. Just keep in mind, these people enslaved to the plantations could barely afford their daily meals, let alone a postage stamp to write back home. So there may have been people who arrived as late as 1911 who still have absolutely no idea which village in India they originate from. And there's a tremendous interest in that. In fact, when we launched the book in Gauteng on the 3rd of December, where Joanne Joseph will chair that session in Bramley, we're carrying along our computers with these records. So when people bring the birth certificates of their parents or grandparents, we can sit and go through all of those details and hopefully find the records of their foremothers and forefathers.
Yeah.
But that said, there's also a class divide in the community of Indian origin in South Africa, in that we're speaking in large part in the Indian African about the people who were indentured, but there are also other folks who were the merchants, the Indian traders who came in the wake of indenture from 1872 to set up shops in different parts of what were then the Transvaal, Natal and the Cape. Of course, in 1890, no Indian was allowed to settle in the Free State. But earlier than this also, other than indenture, there have been Indians who have come to South Africa, for instance, at the Cape, in the wake of the Dutch colonial conquest of the Cape in 1652.
Yeah.
In that period of that century, 50% of all the slaves in the Cape came from India, from Surat, from Gujarat, from the Coromandel Coast, from Bengal. In fact, a name like Cupido, that's very common in the Western Cape,
yeah,
is an Indian name from the Malabar Hills.
Right.
And there's even a longer history to that, which we have the time we'd be able to talk about.
That is fascinating, because I suppose, you know, I've had the pleasure of having a conversation about what we call the Afrikaners on this very show, and similar sort of conversations are had where there are groups that say that they are not Afrikaners, right? They'd rather be understood to be Boere, because they don't necessarily, you know, subscribe to the idea of people that came from the Netherlands with the three ships, who were ostensibly here to come and get provisions to move on. They see themselves as people that were breaking away completely with their European identity, completely. And they would, they find it almost anathema to be called Afrikaners. Although, I mean, if I'm sitting here next to an Afrikaner and a Boer, I wouldn't know the difference. But there's a very, very strong separation there of, I don't know, the way that they see reality. And are you suggesting to me, Kiru, that there are similar fissures even in the Indian community, economically and in terms of status, in terms of, I don't know, in terms of class?
Well, all of our bloodlines overlap. I mean, of this community, excuse me, that you refer to, you know, if you look at the Barsons and even the Terre Blanches, all of their bloodlines overlapped with slaves who came from every part of Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. So nothing is sort of cut and dried in South Africa when it comes to identity, which is why we put this provocative title to our book, The Indian Africans, because it was the activist, photographer, and poet and archivist Omar Bacha who said to us, look at the history through African eyes. So when we look at the history of the people who came from Europe and the Netherlands, and I think that President Thabo Mbeki's speech, I am an African, is instructive in that regard, because we came from everywhere to forge a nation.
Yeah.
And so too, the migrations from India, people who were brought here simply for their labor, those bloodlines merged into the broader South African compact. We even have a clan in the Zulu kingdom who trace their origins to India. And so we've had these are the joys and jeopardies of human existence.
Yeah.
And we can't draw distinctions between anybody in our country.
I am aware of a population group that is African in descent in India. I think they call the Sidi. Am I correct, Selvan? That these are Africans who've been in India as a community of Africans in the diaspora for almost 1,000 years?
Absolutely, that exists. In fact, Kiru was talking through that at the book launch that we did over the weekend. There's an African society that exists in India for a specific period of time, but also in the Andaman Islands. There is a link between India and Africa. And, you know, Kiru just mentioned in terms of the migrations to South Africa. I want to extend, the knowledge in terms of five waves. The first being Dravidian gold miners through this theory put together by Cyril Romnick of Dravidian gold miners arriving through to southern Africa through what is known as Kumati Port.
Mm.
And that word is derived from a Tamil word called Kumati, which is a shop.
Wow.
A shop that still exists in Chennai, Madras at the moment, called Kumati. So, you know, there's all of those narratives of history which come through in terms of one particular migration. And the next is the slave migration of Indians. And then the third being indentured. And then the fourth being the passengers who were brought here to service the indentured and the needs of the indentured. And the fifth, maybe less popular, which I refer to as the Gupta migration. But, you know, I'll get Kiru to speak to that particular migratory group a little later on.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, Kiru would be able to extend himself in terms of, the Siddhi community and his journeys to the Andaman Islands. So, Kiru, maybe you want to chat through that.
So before Kiru, you go there, I mean, you mentioned all of these various phases in the migration process of Indian people of Indian origin coming to, and the various phases, I mean, all the way to the Gupta migration. And for me, it just highlights the complexity of the human situation, of the human reality. It's foolhardy sometimes of us to come to a conclusion that is based on understanding a group of people in a one size fits all sort of approach. I speak as an African, and I realize on a daily basis how many fissures, how many differences exist in the very idea of Africanness, right? And when I listen to these stories and the way that you explain these different phases of immigration, I realize that we need better thinking, better vocalization, better understanding of the human condition and the migratory process just globally. Because it's so easy for us to fall into the lagers, especially when times are hard, right? To fall into the lagers. Kiru, just as Selvin was saying, do you have any comments about the CD people?
Yes, and again, I'm just intrigued by the way you frame that about falling into lagers. We must always be on the guard against that, because when we put ourselves into lagers, that becomes as insidious as apartheid divide and rule. You know, Scandinavians originate in Africa. Indians originate in Africa. And part of the reason we frame this title in this way is we wanted to contest with that debate about ethnicity, race, and identity. Because there's some cockeyed nationalisms that we encounter in South Africa that says, you belong here and you don't belong here, and we want to take those on. But the cities in India are fascinating. You know, there were Africans who were generals in royal armies in India going back for maybe 2,000 years. And, you know, they contributed in large part to the gene pool of what's on the Indian subcontinent, but also further afield in Southeast Asia, in an island like Madagascar, even on the Horn of Africa. We've had this wonderful intermingling of people over time and space. So with the Siddhi community, you go to India and you'll see people who could be very well at home in KwaZulu-Natal in terms of their physical makeup.
Yeah.
But they dress in Indian garb. They're singing sort of songs in Hindi and other languages. But you see there's very much the cultural makeup of being African in their music, in their dance, the drums that they use, for instance, and would not be out of place in southeastern Africa.
Yeah.
So this contact between the continents has been going on for centuries, if not millennia.
Kiru, the contact between Indians at that time and over time with Africans has been not without its issues, right? In as much as there has been a sharing of a history in the fight against the colonial issues, the apartheid issues, there's been a solidarity between Africans here in South Africa and people of Indian descent. But there continues to be fissures and tensions and so forth. Talk to me about that reality, and how do we find a South Africanness within that complexity?
Well, that's an aspect that we don't deny one bit, and we grapple with it, because in any situation where you have this long history of imperialism, of colonialism, of unfettered capitalism, and you know, so many years of apartheid oppression, even where there was common ground, people were forced apart. And we see that as a daily reality. You know, the co-authors of this book are Paul David, a hero of South African freedom, a founder of the United Democratic Front, as well as Ranjit Chunilal. And Paul was a great pains for us to point out that we have worked together going back more than 100 years to create non-racialism, to look at ways of overcoming the divide. And that divide has often taken violent form in the form of race riots like we encountered in 1949. But each time our communities were forced apart by those who wanted to divide and rule, we again found ground, a common ground, to come together. And so even this book, we hope, might be a contribution to deepening non-racialism. And, you know, to use the words of the Indian Nobel laureate, Rabindranath Tagore, is to move beyond narrow domestic walls, to turn to each other rather than on each other. And we want to find platforms where we can help people find each other and build and weld the South African nation that people like Madiba and his generation dreamt of. So we don't gloss over the fissures, but what we're looking for is the platforms to bring people together. And we think that the younger generation of our country, who are not carrying the baggage of our past, might very well have the answers that can move us forward as a nation.
Selvin, as we come to a close, 162 years of Indian existence, and quite frankly, it sounds like it's been much longer if I hear the fact that even as early as 1652, 50% of the slave population in that part of the country, in the Cape of Good Hope, would have been Indian. So maybe we need to revisit that history. What should we leave in our minds as we close?
I think, you know, 28 years into our democracy and where we are now, we realize that we're in a crisis, specifically in terms of our identity in South Africa and our history. I think a lot more needs to be done to be able to get South Africans to understand that we have a multi-layered history, a very diverse history, and we need to respect all of those histories to make up the collective South African narrative. And I think, you know, that's where we probably, not probably, that's where we experience these problems, because we don't know much of the histories of each other.
Yeah.
And I think the school curriculum may be failing in that particular direction. And, you know, you see the divide in the playgrounds. You see it while we have the younger generation that does not have the baggage that we grew up with. But we still see this divide. And it's simply because of not being affronted with the type of education that we ought to see in the classrooms, in celebrating the struggle history, histories like indenture and slavery, in a much bolder way than we ought to be seeing it. So I think, you know, that's the responsibility that calls to us as South Africans in the years ahead, to be able to embrace the history of indenture as a part of the South African collectiveness, consciousness. And I think this is something that needs to happen on a regular basis, because, you know, we go to Europe and I want to use the word, we're affronted by that history. But in South Africa, we lose names of, you know, people in the struggle history, and a lot of our those names are lost to the pages of history, is because we fail to get those names
Selvin,
into the consciousness of
people. And Kiru,
that's the responsibility.
I've got to stop because we've completely run out of time. I would have loved to continue this conversation, and I agree. These are the kinds of conversations that must continue. Kiru Naidu, Selvin Naidu, thank you so much for joining us.